Tonight's a really special night and a really special subject. On the Saturday show, we always try to do something with our very good partners, the United States Air Force, to highlight a different command, a different story. And tonight is something that really just gelled together with something that I'm very near and dear to my heart and to my memory, or the memory of one of my big heroes growing up. So we have some really exciting stuff we're going to talk about. I have chills being on stage with the object that you see on stage, which will come to sort of a full circle and clearer picture here in a few minutes. Before we get truly started, our friends at the Pacific Air Forces have arranged a video to warm up the night. So let's see this amazing video that he brought with us.
Fueled by trailblazing innovation, powered by warrior ethos, and united under a common mission: defend the United States, safeguard the nation's interests, and promote regional security alongside our allies and partners. We are Pacific Air Forces. We stand with our allies and partners with unwavering dedication to a free and open Indo-Pacific, ready to defeat adversaries with unmatched firepower and lethality. We continuously transform and advance our capabilities, extending our operational reach to ensure superiority across the region. From deterring military aggression to delivering rapid relief, we are at the forefront of stability and security in the Pacific. Forged by a heritage of excellence, honor, and valor, Pacific Airmen have never been more powerful in the way we fly, fight, and win. We are Pacific Air Forces. Together, we dominate the skies for our nation, for our allies, for our future.
Mike Minahan, 35 years of Air Force service, with his final assignment as commander of the Air Mobility Command.
That video, that was awesome. Now I got the volume going. All right. Happy Saturday. Happy verge of another fantastic night air show, which is going to be incredible. My name's Mike Minahan. I had the honor to wear the cloth of the United States Air Force for 35 years. And fly C-130s and do amazing things. The best part of all of that is the incredible people that we get to work with each and every day. And at the top of that list, and an honor to introduce, is General Kevin Schneider, the PACAF commander, Pacific Air Forces commander. No pressure, but he leads about 50,000 airmen. He's responsible for air dominance in over half the globe. In his kit, beyond amazing airmen, are fighters, rescue, tankers, airlift, and all the things in between that. He handles tough problem sets like China, North Korea, and all of the humanitarian assistance and disasters that happen on that side of the globe. He's flown F-15s, he's flown helicopters, he's flown the F-22, but if you ask him, he's a Viper driver as an F-16 pilot. His leadership has been validated in combat and crisis on a daily basis. And even though all that is amazing, his best attributes are: he's a friend, he's a warrior, he's a mentor, he is an incredible, amazing airman, he is an incredible, amazing American, and he is the finest human at the top of the list. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my honor to introduce you to my favorite fighter pilot, Gumby Schneider.
Thanks, brother. Minnie is wrong about a lot of things about my career, right about one thing. I have tremendous friends, and he is at the top of that list. The only bad thing I can say about General Minahan
is because he is so much taller than me, usually when he comes in for a hug, he's able to get both arms over both of my shoulders, which leaves me in an awkward position of trying to hug a 6'5" Irishman around the waist. But we have worked through that. Hey, thanks everyone. I really appreciate you being here, and it's a privilege for me to be here and to be a small part of this event. And obviously, as I get reminded of this every time I walk into the door at home and my wife tells me I'm not the main event. The main event is going to follow after I finish speaking. But looking across this crowd, I'm reminded of exactly why we serve. I see the faces of veterans who have served before us and have lit that torch that we follow. I see families who hold our communities together. And then for the young folks in the crowd, younger folks in the crowd, I see those young patriots who are looking forward to the horizon, to the future. And on behalf of the men and women of Pacific Air Forces, I just want to thank all of you for your roles and what you do as citizens and to make our country and to keep our country great. And we're honored to share, I am honored to be here to share the PACAF mission with you just briefly in terms of what it is that we do and also to be part of this year's Oshkosh. Next slide. So I want to kind of share with you the responsibility our command holds. The Pacific region, you know, when the U.S. military draws lines on a map and says you're responsible for this part of the world, the Pacific is 100 million square miles. By comparison, the mainland United States is 3 million square miles. That line on the map goes from the west side of India, it goes towards the west coast of the United States, it goes from the Bering Strait up in Alaska and Russia, and all the way down to Antarctica. That line, that part of the map, covers 52% of the Earth's surface. One of my predecessors used to describe it this way: Hollywood to Bollywood, polar bears to penguins, and everything that's in between. And it's an enormous area of responsibility with enormous consequences for the region and the world if we do not maintain the peace and stability there. As many mentioned, I have the tremendous honor of leading about 46,000, day in and day out, about 46,000 airmen across Pacific Air Forces. And we are stationed at bases from Korea to Japan, from Guam to Hawaii to Alaska. And then we operate airplanes all over that area. We don't do it alone. We do it with Air Mobility Command. We've got General Sankis here in the audience tonight. We do it with Air Force Global Strike Command, who operates bombers, and with all the elements of the joint force. As you look at the news today, you'll recognize that, you know, we live in challenging times. And even with stuff going on in other parts of the world, the Pacific is still and can be a potentially volatile place. But we are able to maintain that peace, the stability, and the prosperity in three broad ways. Next slide. I argue, and I'll say this to the day that I can no longer take breath, is we enjoy three asymmetric advantages every single day. And the first is the quality of our people. The airmen that are out there doing the job, the men and women in uniform who are out there bending wrenches, driving fuel trucks, flying airplanes, collecting intel, building our bases, taking care of airmen and families. And that also applies across the entirety of the U.S. Joint Force, not just the Air Force, but the Army, the Navy, the Marines, Coast Guardsmen, and the Guardians. We work together as a team, as a joint force, and we have done this both in competition and peacetime, and certainly in conflict. We know how to team together to solve problems. And the third asymmetric advantage is our allies and partners. And that network continues to grow stronger and more involved every day. The pictures that you're seeing up at the top part is a trilateral. It's a three-nation exercise between the United States, the Australians, and the Japanese. We're all operating F-35s. We do this together. We operate the highest technology capabilities in the most challenging exercises routinely. We know how to work with each other. We know how to be interoperable, and we know how to do each other's jobs. You know, the picture at the bottom is the air chiefs, a snapshot of about two dozen of the air chiefs in the region, and I have regular conversations with them. I realize that's not the most exciting thing I could be talking about. the picture in the bottom center, just to talk about the closeness of our joint force, that picture is an elephant walk. And typically at each of our bases, we'll roll out all the shiny metal and we'll put it on the runway just to show how much power we can project. And that's a cool picture, and that's Kadena Air Base in Okinawa, Japan. But that's not just Air Force. You see the Patriot interceptors that are part of the Army that defend our bases. If you look closely into the picture, there are Navy aircraft and Marine aircraft, just showing the power of the joint force. And then in the bottom right, you know, a bilateral parachute jump with the Japanese using our C-130 aircraft. We do stuff like this every day. And we do this, all of this, to send a crystal clear message, one, to our allies that we're with you and we're reliable teammates and we are capable of defending what we say we're going to defend. We also do this to potential adversaries to make sure that they understand that we can project power at the time and place of our choosing anywhere around the world. Next slide. But I'll tell you from personal experience, and for all of us that wear the uniform, you know, these massive theater-wide operations do not just happen by themselves. And it's not just because of the strength of the airmen, that much is clear, but because of the support of our families at home who allow us to do this. So to the families here tonight, I want to speak directly to you just for a second, just to say thank you. I am not here today based on my own skills and talents. I am here because I have a family that has supported me and a wife that has sacrificed her career at least three times to allow me to continue to serve. We ask a lot from our service members today. We ask them to master new technologies. We ask them to operate in pretty intense environments. We ask them to operate in austere environments and under a lot of pressure, thousands of miles away from home. But we know that heaviest burden is often carried in silence by the family members. Next. And it's the spouse that really carries the burden, or the family members on the home front that carry so much of it. And I know from my own personal experience, when I was deployed, my kids would have calendars counting down the days until they thought I returned. I usually did not meet that mark because something else would happen, or I'd get extended, or we'd get something else would happen. And I've lost track of the number of anniversaries, birthdays, holidays, and special events that I have missed. And that's even more magnified across the entirety of the force. So as an American citizen, to all the families who support service members, I just want to say thank you for allowing that to happen. But our ultimate strength is our airmen. For all the cool airplanes and all the neat pictures that I just showed, it's the human beings and all that picture that is our true strength. So to our airmen, and certainly to the families that love them, enable them, and support them, you have my deepest gratitude. Next slide. But I tell you that part of it to tell you this, and to help with the transition into what we're going to do next. And it's I want to share the story of the connection between love of family and love of country. And it's certainly not new. That has stood the test of time from the early days of our nation as we were becoming who we were. And about 85 years ago, our nation faced a profound crisis in the aftermath of 7 December 1941. We were in an existential fight. We were in one in Europe, but certainly one in the Pacific. And the one in the Pacific was not necessarily looking great, not going well for us in the early stages of the war. But you know, despite the tragedy that unfolded before our eyes in 1941 and some of the devastating losses in 1942, this nation found resolve. It galvanized its strength. It came together in ways that touched, you know, both the human being, but certainly our aircraft and the machinery that were being produced in mass numbers. We had an advantage, even through those trying times, and that advantage was our airmen. Our American airmen. I'll share a little bit of a story about one of them tonight, and obviously you know where this is going. It's Dick Bong, you know, a farm boy from Poplar, Wisconsin, who became a legend and remains a legend. The building across from the headquarters I work in is named in honor of him. It is our command and control center, so every day hundreds of airmen walk in and out of the Major Richard Bong Air Operations Center. We have memorabilia honoring his legacy and what he did, and his name, his legacy, his example is never far from the minds of our airmen at Pacific Air Forces. For the younger folks here, Major Bong was America's ace of aces. He remains the highest scoring fighter pilot in America history of all time, shooting down 40 enemy aircraft in the Pacific in World War II. He did this all from the cockpit of a P-38 Lightning, challenging aircraft to fly, but he certainly mastered that early on. And normally when you hear a reference like ace of aces, you think of Hollywood glamour, good looks, you think of ego, you think of attitude, and you think of, you know, just someone that, a swaggering, boastful type. We'll give Major Bong credit for the staggering good looks, but not for the ego. For those that knew him, and if you've read about him, he was the exact opposite. He was quiet, almost shy, deeply humble throughout his career. He was the consummate teammate. For all of those that flew with him or were in his unit, it was always about his formation, it was about his squadron, it was about his unit, it was not about himself. He is the definition of professional humility and remains that way today. And that spirit is what we encourage in our airmen, and we again look to Major Bong's example as one of the guiding lights that helps shape us in how we think and how we operate. Our airmen do not rest on yesterday's victories. We learn from history, and we train relentlessly for tomorrow's challenges. One of the first things I did when I got into my job was I read works from my predecessors, going back to George Kenney and others, and every reference to Major Bong, he never sees himself as a conqueror, never sees himself as anything other than a teammate. You know, he's driven by a quiet, fierce sense of duty, and he fought for the name that was painted on the nose of his aircraft, Marge, the young woman waiting for him back at home. And in December of 1944, you know, as Major Bong and other pilots in his units were literally tearing up the 4,500 miles between Brisbane, Australia and Japan and reducing the enemy force, in December of 44, General MacArthur awarded Major Bong the Congressional Medal of Honor, introducing him into what he called the Society of the Bravest of the Brave. Tragically, Major Bong did not get to see the peace that ensued that came about in September of 1945. He had been called back from the theater of operations and was doing flight testing in California when tragically he lost his life on August 6, 1945. And obviously the panel is going to share, that comes up after me, is going to share a little bit of his legacy. But I share Major Bong's story with you tonight, and one that I think many of you know well, because the thread connecting his generation to ours is not broken. It continues to remain, it continues to exist. And when our airmen deploy across the Pacific today in a lot of the same locations or areas in which Major Bong operated, working off of remote runways, austere locations, challenging supply lines, in the sweltering heat and humidity, and executing incredibly complex missions over vast distances, they are carrying on Major Bong's legacy every single time they do that. So that torch continues to be passed, and it continues, and Major Bong's example continues to set that mark on the wall for all of us. And they represent the quiet, they represent the best of us, you know, the quiet warriors who do not boast, who understand what the job is, and they get after it. So when you look at the complex challenges facing our nation today, and you certainly don't have to go too far into the news to figure that out, I would ask you not to be discouraged and just recognize that our airmen, our sailors, our Marines, our soldiers, our Coast Guardsmen, and our guardians are out there standing the watch, and they are standing the watch incredibly well. So to our veterans that are in the audience, thank you for building the foundation for our freedom, and the legacy of courage and your sacrifice continues to exist. And maybe one side note about veterans, I in the very early 1980s when I was thinking about what I was going to do with my life and the path I was going to pursue. The veteran population in the United States of America was about 18% of the population, 1/8. And I did not have to go far up and down my street in Springfield, Virginia to find military veterans and to talk to them. My side hustle at the time was mowing lawns and cutting grass to make money to put gas in a 1971 Karmann Ghia. Regret losing that car, but it was very easy for me to find veterans and to hear their stories and to be motivated by that. And I would argue, and some would say, it had an influence on my life because I'm standing here today, largely because of that. Today, within our society in America, veterans make up only 6% of our population. The challenges have not changed, or if they've changed, they've got a little bit more intertwined, more interconnected, and more volatile. The influence of veterans is even more important today than it was when I was in high school trying to figure out what I was doing with my life. So again, to the veterans out there, just thank you for the example that you continue to set. For those of you who are not veterans, and certainly for the younger generation, please, I would encourage you to talk to those that have served, to hear their stories and to understand what sacrifice and commitment meant to them and how their service influenced their life. To our military families, I just want to say thank you for allowing your loved ones to serve in whatever role that is. Again, I am not here based on my own strength and my own volition. I am here because my family has allowed me to do this, and they are the ones that have made the sacrifices. And to all of you here from communities across the country, thank you for standing with the men and women who proudly wear the uniform, whichever one it is, from across the services. And as we celebrate our nation's 250th anniversary, please know that America's Air Force, your Air Force, will continue to defend, deter, and prevail across all challenges. So thank you for your time tonight. Chris is going to come out here and we'll transition over to share more about Mission Marge and the recovery of this aircraft with the connection to Major Bong. But I hope you enjoyed tonight's air show. And again, thank you for all of you for what you do. Thank you for your citizenship and for continuing to be great Americans. You have a great night.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that airplane and about the people who work to help preserve and tell the stories. I'm the museum director here. We have a P-38 painted in Richard Bong's markings. We work very closely with the Bong Museum, and they have a P-38 beautifully restored as well. It tells Richard Bong's story, of course. We'll talk about that. So we're very passionate about the story. Myself and our museum curator, Hope Stropes, and Ike Lankow work very hard to make sure people know that story. Brianna and her team do amazing work, which you're going to hear from as well. So before we get too far down the road, I do want to call out, we have some special guests here in the front row that I don't think they knew I was going to call them out. I hope they're still friends with me after I do this. But we actually have family members of Richard Bong here tonight. Would you guys like to stand up for us? And everybody give them a warm EA welcome. Hopefully you guys don't hate me after that. I'm also very stunned to be standing downwind of this amazing artifact. And we're going to talk a little bit about how that piece came here tonight and what its future is. So it brings me great honor to bring out people who I've had the chance to work with over the years, like Brianna, use as sources of research, like Justin, and look up to and aspire to be more like Adria. So ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome to Mission Marge. All right, so before we go too far also, just want to let you know we're going to do Q&A, so you can ask questions. I'm usually the voice that you're asking questions to backstage, so they'll be coming to my phone, so don't think that I'm like checking Instagram or something. I'm just kind of monitoring the questions for us. So Brianna, I'm going to start with you. You and I go way back, many years, I'm not even sure how many now at this point. Tell us first off a little bit about
your museum. Tell us what you guys do, what is the day-to-day, and a little bit maybe of its history.
Yeah, I would be happy to. I am the curator at the Richard Bong Veterans Museum up in Superior, Wisconsin. And we have been there for over 20 years. We opened in 2002. But the history of our area honoring Major Bong goes much further back. They started a memorial for him very shortly after his death. There was a P-38 that was located outside the school in Poplar for many, many years. And the need to restore that P-38 is sort of what started our museum. They restored that museum and then, or they restored that P-38 and then they needed a building for it to go into. So the community raised money and built the Bong Veterans Museum in Superior. And so we have been honoring our local veterans now for over 20 years in Richard Bong's name. It is not a museum just for Richard Bong. That is something that he would not have wanted. He would have wanted us to honor all veterans.
So the picture you're looking at on screen, that is the P-38 named Marge. I believe he had two different Marges in combat at one point. Justin's probably the expert on that. I had a chance to meet Marge once here. And she told me that Dick always said I was the most shot at girl in the Southwest Pacific. So I think that's fantastic. Do we want to talk a little bit about the history of the photo, just what it was?
So this is his first Marge airplane. He put the markings on this plane in March of 1944. We'll get into the history of it later. He didn't fly this plane for very long, but because he beat Eddie Rickenbacker shortly after this plane crashed, that picture was used in all of the press. So this Marge plane became very famous when the press were talking about Dick becoming the highest scoring American ace.
Well, and so tonight we're going to talk about expeditions and so many different groups working together. It's truly amazing that this was able to happen. Tell us a little bit about the inspiration for this. How did this start to go out and look for the airplane?
It started I think it goes back years, and actually I will tell a little story. It in many parts is prompted by a conversation I had with you back in the early 2020s, and I was curious about what had happened to the Marge aircraft, and I had recently found out about the partnership between PNG and the Wisconsin Air National Guard, and it made it seem like it might be possible to go actually find the airplane. And you mentioned, oh, I think it crashed in Papua New Guinea. I think you got that reference from Justin's website. And then I reached out to Justin, and then it snowballed from there.
And I mean, it's amazing how you were able, through the Air National Guard, to work directly with the folks in New Guinea. Do we want to have them talk about the process and how that started?
I think I'm going to let Adria talk about that, because she really started she initiated the contact with us about getting the Wisconsin Air National Guard involved.
Yeah, so the Wisconsin National Guard is a formal partner with Papua New Guinea. It's all the states have guard units, and they formalize that. So we have a long history through our Army National Guard brothers who were over there in World War II. When I read about it in the newspaper, we just made contact. Now, there wasn't anything the National Guard could do to help with the recovery, but we did have the ability to transport on some mission that we had actually coming out of Papua New Guinea anyways. So it took a little bit, but we were able to stay in our lane. We were able to cheer on from outside, and then when it was time to do what we could, we did.
So anybody that knows me knows I also have a massive love for tankers, so awesome to hear that, and really honored to have you guys on stage with us tonight. So how did this all happen? Like, who do you reach out to in New Guinea first? Like, Like, how are we going to go get the airplane? Does that start with you? I might know where it's at, or walk me through it.
Sure. Good evening, everyone. I'm Justin Talon from Pacific Rex, and I'm going to tell you about how we found Marge. It all began with the email that Brianna sent asking, where is Richard Bong's P-38 Marge? And I replied to her truthfully, saying, I don't know, but let's find out. That began a process of doing research, checking in the National Archives, the Air Force Archives in Maxwell for all the information about this airplane, its status card, Bong's flight records, and because the plane was lost, flown by another pilot who bailed out, it was actually a really difficult loss to research. There was no fatality. Gathering all the information and really the simplest, most rudimentary facts, the point it took off, NADZAB, and the fact that minutes into the flight, the pilot experienced engine issues and bailed out, drawing a line, estimating the cruise speed of a P-38, put an X on the map as the most probable location. Papua New Guinea is halfway around the world. It's a beautiful country. It's rugged, full of mountains, rainforest, kunai grass, and so forth. Finding anything there by just walking around is impossible. The way that we were able to locate it is going to that probable area, talking to local communities, and asking them about World War II history that existed in their land. And thanks to the help of our friends from Papua New Guinea over there, we were able to find the airplane. So it was quite a journey 2 years ago to locate and identify the aircraft.
And thank you guys for traveling all the way from New Guinea, correct? To be here, that's incredible. Thank you. We hope, absolutely.
That's Norman Nyack at the end, who is a man who is from the area where the Marge crash site is located. And he volunteered to help us. He came with us, helped us to negotiate and gain access to the right people. So Norman, maybe you could share a little about how you came to know Pacific Rex and work on this project.
Right. Good evening all. Again, I am Norman Nyack from Papua New Guinea, and I come from the place where Richard Bong left his aeroplane some 80 plus years ago. And I am happy to be present here to just testify a little about how I met Pacific Rex and how we did complete the mission to discover the plane. So I never knew Pacific Rex until they went to my place, to my province, where they requested to carry out the search. So I have to be on board voluntarily, and we went to discover the villages, asking them if there were any war relics or wrecks in the place, and they showed us one, which was Japanese plane. So the other day, we were told that there was one in the jungle, and it would take 3 to 4 hours walk. And I asked Justin if this is possible, and he agreed that we should take a walk up. So it took us almost 4 hours searching for the plane in the jungle until the locals that we went with located the actual crash site, and they called for us. So we started lifting all the pieces, and Justin said, you have to look for any numbering on the piece. So we started checking the metals everywhere until we identified a few identification or numbering, serial number, data plate number, and right in the bush, Justin and the two crews started jumping up and down, and we were all surprised what was happening because we didn't know that it values to Americans here. We were only thinking because many of those wrecks have been sold as scrap metals. So, you know, people never valued that. So when Justin and two crews start jumping and shouting and clapping, it just got us by surprise. And I asked what it was or what was found. And he said, this is a plane that Americans have been looking for over 80 years. And at last, we have identified the plane. So we took this part, pieces, we turned it over, and we saw the paint was there, numbering was there. So he showed us and said, this is exact plane. And it's a great mystery and a win for Americans who have been missing this plane in here. So quickly he asked me if we could do a local celebration, and I organized community to have a celebration on this, and we were broadcasting live from the village, the finding that time. That is one part, one part that the mission was complete, that we locate the plane. The other part, second part of it, was to respond to late Jerry, the sister of Major Richard Bong, who was live that time when we came on live, and she requested in a video meeting that she wants to have at least a part of this to be returned to Wisconsin. And Justin said, can we do it? I said, we have different traditions, and it would take time for us to negotiate. So I volunteered, and on behalf of my government, local government, provincial government, and national government, where the museum is responsible for all the relics in the country, I represented them to negotiate with the landowners, fighting for this piece to be taken over to USA. So that's why it took us almost 2 years, breaking through and negotiating to make sure the communities were happy to accept the peace to be returned to the veteran museum here in Wisconsin. So I think that's what I could say. It was really a surprise to us. Later on, it became a legacy that we saw that we should maintain, we should grow to hold the tie between U.S. and Papua New Guinea. So that, with that understanding, the community were happy to send this. However, because we have different history or traditions that we used to display during marriage or wedding ceremony. So I just would like to explain how it happens in our community. If there was a wedding taking place, normally, a bride and a groom meets, and then before taking the bride to the groom's home, there is always one party of the bride to be accompanied to take the bride to a new home, to leave it with the groom at his place, and make sure that the bride sits well, stays well, and then the family member or the representative comes back to the community. So following that, I was so happy that Pacific Rex, Justin Talen, told me that I will try my best to have your visa, U.S. visa approved, so that you will come with us to USA. So it took us some time to Port Moresby, and then I was thinking if I would come to fulfill the tradition that we have to have the march as a bride taken over to Wisconsin, to be placed in the place that I would go back and tell the story to the people that have kept this march for over 8 years. So this is how it happened, with the help of the Wisconsin Air Force, General Giucaro, with a team. They were so kind to help us shift this piece from my country over to Guam, to Hawaii, and to Wisconsin, which is a really great story. And it's a legacy that we both countries want to share and maintain. With that, thank you very much.
I just want to say on behalf of all of us here what an honor it is to have you both here, traveling from so far, so thank you. Absolutely. Just a fair warning, if you stay here too long, you will start eating cheese, drinking beer, and rooting for the Packers. So I'm just going to make sure you're given fair warning. Yes. So, Justin, How did it feel to find this airplane, to know you're there, you're where this airplane came to rest? And it's such a historic airplane.
Well, as Norman said, when we located a unique identifier, the serial number of the airplane, and if you look at this wingtip, it's just on the lower side. Norman, maybe you can point to it. It's hard to see, but it's a stenciled 993, the last three digits of the U.S. Army Air Force serial number. And, of course, the red paint that you see there was the personal motif of Richard Bong, just like on this model. You can also see the end of the star and bar, the U.S. insignia. So the wingtip, first of all, really looks like a piece of the airplane. It has these diagnostic features. They are painted stencils where they have been preserved for 82 years, but if kept in the jungle forever, will one day disappear. So because of that, this was the candidate piece to really recover, have it in a preserved museum environment, and so forth. But what did it feel like? Wow, it was a great moment, as Norman said. I guess I was screaming and shouting and clapping. Not for my own glory, but knowing how much this would mean to the Bong family. At that time, one of Richard Bong's siblings, his sister Jerry, was alive. And she had participated in our briefings, and I imagined what she would think and feel. And of course, for all Americans, the state of Wisconsin, I mean, Richard Bong is America's ace of ace. Everybody knows his name. Everybody's seen a picture of this airplane. I was imagining how much this would mean to our country and to the Bong family.
Just out of curiosity, looking at the pictures, how hard was it to get there? That looks like it may have been some pretty rough terrain. I'm just gonna let you guys know, like, if we started and I saw a snake, I'd be gone. So just wondering, like, what were some of those challenges? How hard was it to get there?
Well, to answer that question, I'm gonna pass the mic over to Richard Bong's nephew, Mitch, who made that trek and is a relative. So Mitch, maybe you can share what that journey was like.
Well, it was a little bit different than I anticipated. When we were told to be in shape because you're going to walk through 7 miles of jungle, got to be able to walk over a pipeline, over a stream, and then you're going to be hammered with bugs and mosquitoes the whole nine yards. And I thought, well, okay, I can do this. I've dealt with cold weather, not a problem. So, it all starts out with you fly forever and ever, and then you get to PNG, and you're thinking, okay, let's go to the next step. And all of a sudden, here comes a boat, a banana boat, pulls up alongside. He said, okay, gang, throw all your gear in. We're taking this open boat up in the ocean for about an hour and a half, and then we're going to slide up on the beach, and then going to have a little village here. And from there on, we're going to have to hike up the trail and get it done. So, okay. So one thing Norman mentioned is, in one of those pictures before, it had us standing there all full of red paint.
Oh.
And that was the village's way of welcoming us. We didn't expect a welcome committee. But we got there, and the first thing it did is welcome us is slap the red dye on our face. That was the welcome. And you can see from the picture there, we have our dye on. So, and actually, this picture here shows the ceremony to where the local villages decided, in their tradition, they give a spear and a bow, and that's their way of turning their ownership over to us. So that said, yes, we can go on our way. And it was a heck of a journey. It wasn't anywhere near expected until maybe the last, I'd say, mile or two when we actually did it into the jungle, and it was steep and it was hot. And so we did get to the site, and it was kind of a quiet moment when you actually got to the place where Marge is final resting spot. And I know one question was going to ask, what did the Hmong feel about this? And I think everyone out here in the Hmong family has got their own feelings about it, as I do. And it's very special to me. I grew up with that airplane because I grew up on a farm. Every day when we would go to school or go into town, there was a P-38 sitting at the school. If you went to the bank, you went to the store, you went anywhere, that P-38 was there. It was like a family member. We had a lot of the history of Dick's in the house in various stacks and files, whatever, before it started being moved on to the Hmong Center, because it was at the visitors' trophy room, we used to call it, and our parents used to, and various members of the community would volunteer there. So it's very, very important that we get this piece back.
So I have to ask, Brianna, what was your reaction when, and how does that work? Does Justin call you directly, or how did you find out that they had found the crash site?
So the first, in 2024, when they found the crash site, we had Starlink out there. So we had almost instantaneous connection with them. And so we found out, I believe the same day or within 24 hours of them finding the crash site, we had photographs from the crash site that we could look at and see the see this wingtip here with the serial number on it. So all of us, myself and Joe here and John, who are involved at the museum, we're so excited, and we really couldn't believe how fast it happened. Within just a couple weeks, Justin was there and had found it, and it was incredibly, I think it says a lot to the connections that he has with the people in PNG and how much assistance we got from the people there.
I guess my next question would be, how was the conversation to bring it back? Was that a decision? How did that go? Where it was, how are we going to get permission? Should we bring the piece back? Walk me through it.
I'm just going to answer very quickly and say that the museum, from the beginning, and Justin feels very strongly about this, and we did too, that we wanted to follow all of the rules. We didn't want to do anything illegal. We didn't want to take anything that we shouldn't have, and so we were very determined to do everything right. And so it took us 2 years to secure those permissions. And so then I'm gonna turn it over to Greg over there. He is he works at the National Museum in Papua New Guinea, and he will explain how that partnership worked.
Thank you, Brianna. My name is Greg. I'm the chief curator of the Modern History Department at the PNG National Museum and Art Gallery. So the Marge wreck is legally a property of the Papua New Guinean state. This is a product of the history of our legislations. It comes underneath a piece of legislation called the War Surplus Material Act, which was put in place by the Australian Colonial Administration in 1952. So after World War II, there was a booming scrap metal industry, a multi-million dollar scrap metal industry. And people from all over the world went to places like New Guinea to salvage scrap metal and, you know, ship on them overseas and smelt them and use them to make weapons to fight other wars, that kind of thing. So the Australian Colonial Administration put in place this legislation, and it was parked underneath our finance, or the Colonial Administration's finance department, so that they would generate some revenue from exports. So then come by the 1980s and the 1990s, it was decided that this refuse of war, this metallic refuse of war, should be valued for their cultural and historical heritage rather than their scrap metal values. And that's when this legislation was parked underneath the National Museum and Art Gallery, which is responsible for securing and promoting the cultural, historical and cultural diversity of Papua New Guinea. So that's a bit about the ownership of all war surplus materials, which also covers human remains. And we work very closely with foreign human remains recovery missions from the three former combatant nations that fought in New Guinea. And it also covers the Marge wreck. So the agreement we made was for this piece of the Marge to be given on permanent loan to the Bong Center. And as part of that agreement, the Bong Center also was able to help us bring in another piece of the wreck to Port Moresby, where we also have a Bong exhibition at our new Aviation Heritage Center, and that will enhance our existing exhibition on Bong. And so the whole remainder of the wreck is in the jungle in Medang province, Norman's province. But you know, by distributing the materiality of this wreck piece, it's able to promote this kind of war tourism. It's able to generate this kind of interest. And prior to that, every other wreck that's been taken out of Papua New Guinea and brought to the U.S. has been stolen and taken out illegally. So we're proud of this this relationship that we have, and we want to promote it as a model. Yep. Thank you to Justin Talen of Pacific Rex, who I know guided Brianna and the team through all the legal issues surrounding, you know, the National Museum and the provincial governments, everything. So Justin Talen has done a tremendous job guiding the international team. He's been a pivotal part of, you know, the success of this mission. Norman at the local level. You know, Norman's involvement is important because even though we can give a permit to an international team to go in and look for the wrecks at the national level, because 97% of land in Papua New Guinea is traditionally owned, when you go down to a village, you still have to go through traditional leadership systems. You have to talk to big men, you have to talk to chiefs, you have to talk to the heads of clans. So Norman was instrumental in leading the international team, maneuvering those political leadership, those different systems of government in our villages. Papua New Guinea, we have 5 levels of government, from the national, provincial, district, local level, and ward, which you go through. But then when you go to the village, you still go through a chieftaincy or a clan system, that kind of thing. So Norman was instrumental in that. So thank you, Norman. Yeah, I think that's a bit about the ownership of the wreck. One thing I will say, you know, the critical lesson of this mission lies in a profound philosophical distinction between exchange and extraction. So to understand the depth of this project, one must understand the soul of Papua New Guinea. Now, in Melanesian social relations, exchange is not a mere financial transaction. It is our foundational principle. It is the very fabric that binds humans together across valleys, oceans, and generations. So to us, a gift given requires a relationship sustained. An exchange establishes an enduring bond of balance, reciprocity, and peace between two parties. It dictates how we resolve conflicts and how we build alliances and how we recognize the humanity in one another. So an extraction, on the other hand, is inherently violent. It's one-sided, it diminishes the source, while an exchange is inherently peaceful and relational. It elevates both parties. So by transforming the Mission Marge into an exchange rather than an extraction, the Bong Museum, the Bong Center, the Pacific Rex, the Wisconsin National Air Guard. You know, they've spoken to us not in the core language of global economics, but in the universal and sacred language of respect. So thank you.
It's so amazing and refreshing to see everybody sort of paddling the boat the same direction, all for a sake of a good cause, to honor America's ace of aces and at the same time respect your home. I mean, that is truly amazing. Well done to everybody.